take whatever developed during that first stage, and what you should have noticed from your reading of the material that was distributed to you about these stages. The overview of psychoanalytic theory, the discussion of these stages begins on the back of page one, page two. What you should have noted is that Freud presents information on these stages in terms of two polarities. For each stage or each phase of each stage, things are presented in terms of extreme opposites or polarities. The closer one gets to either extreme, the less normal that individual is. Normal is a compromise right smack in the middle, a blend of the characteristics of each of the two phases. That's normal. Right smack dab in the middle. Freud tells us that as development proceeds from the head down, so does our awareness of our own body, and therefore, in stage two, according to Freud, the child's awareness shifts from taking in with getting, with receiving, with incorporating, with consummatory functions of the body, to excretory functions of the body and the processes involved in the elimination of bodily waste. If the first stage had a lot of implications and possibilities and potential for long-term effects on one's personality and one's character, stage two perhaps has even more. This is the stage, according to Freud, when for the first time every individual comes headlong into conflict with society and the demands of society for compliance, conformity to societal expectations. The demands of society as they are interpreted to each of us by our parents and or other socializing adults. Freud tells us that this second stage is a stage that has far-reaching implications in terms of the development of the superego, not just the ego, but the superego. A lot of ego development takes place in stage one. It is in stage two we see the second structure of personality, or third structure, beginning to emerge. That superego, all the shoulds and the shouldn'ts, the do's and the don'ts, the right and the wrong, the appropriate and inappropriate, acceptable and unacceptable. Freud said in stage two, we encounter the first major socialization demands made upon us by society that come under a general umbrella heading called cleanliness training. And that includes personal hygiene, it includes manners and eating habits, and it includes the one that Freud thought was most important, and that was the process of toilet training. Students wonder why psychoanalytic theory, and Freud in particular, makes such a great deal out of the process of toilet training. Why such inordinate emphasis? Think about it from a psychoanalytic perspective. It is in this stage, and up until this stage begins, the elimination of bodily waste, both urination and defecation, are taken care of automatically through reflexes as they have been since the child was born. It is in this stage, says Freudian theory, that for the first time, the child is expected to develop and to exercise conscious, voluntary control over behaviors that were previously automatic reflex reactions. When this stage first begins, the child is starting to develop, and very inconsistently, I might add, the necessary neurological and muscular developments that make retaining bodily waste possible until the appropriate time and place are at hand for a child to take care of that the way they're supposed to. But it's inconsistent, it's episodic, it's not consistent neuromuscular control. Conscious voluntary control over reflex behavior. Freud then tells us, no little kid this age has an abstract self-concept, and he's quite right. A child this age has an awareness of himself or herself in terms of their own physical being. It's not I, some abstract sense of self, it's me, physical me. So if in going through the process of toilet training, kids sometimes evidence a delay in acquiring appropriate attitudes or behavior patterns, etc. And parents become frustrated and impatient, and they direct negative feedback to the child that they're messy and naughty and non-compliant and bad and not nice. Those comments, says Freudian theory, are not accepted by the child as being with reference to some abstract sense of self. Those comments are accepted by the child as being with reference to their own bodies, because that's the me that they know. If you pick up a toy and say to a little kid, whose toy is this? They say me, and they look at themselves and they point to them. So Freud says, in going through this process, our attitudes toward our own bodies, our attitudes toward natural bodily functions, our attitudes toward a region of the body which later in the course of human development and maturation become associated with sex and sexuality are all under formation during this process. Not some abstract thing, physical, tangible, the child's body. So Freud tells us in the beginning of this stage, there's the first phase. It's called the expulsive phase. The expulsive phase means that the elimination of bodily waste on the part of the child is taken care of automatically. It's expelled. But gradually the child starts to develop neurological and muscular controls necessary to retain bodily waste or postpone or eliminate bodily waste by delaying it for a little while. Freud also says that little kids this age, there's lots of demands being made on them. And one of the things you have to think about before a child can be effectively toilet trained is that the child needs to be able to express their needs verbally to their parents. They need to be able to tell their parents they need to use the bathroom. That, if you think about it for a moment, is an anticipatory response to a situation. Little kids this age are extremely spontaneous. They live in the present moment, in the here and now. They are not accustomed to thinking about or anticipating the future or anticipating the consequences of their behavior on what's going to happen after that. Little kids have very short attention spans. Parents don't want the child to tell them after they've gone to the bathroom or while they're going to the bathroom, after they've soiled the diaper. They want to know before the fact so they can get the kid. I mean, every little kid is in the process of learning that there's a special room in the house when and where you take care of toilet functions, not when and where you please. child has to be able to express their needs, which means language development needs to have progressed and started so they can articulate their needs. What are some of the psychological characteristics that Freud is interested in terms of this second stage, phase one of the second stage, the expulsive phase? If I had to come up with one word, one single word, to describe the way little kids function in this phase of this stage, the word would be impulsive. Impulsivity, to be overly spontaneous, to not think before you act, to not think before you speak, to not anticipate the consequences of your behavior, but just to be very reactive, spur of the moment. Freud also tells us that there is a tendency, because kids in this stage, their ego isn't that far developed, and they are kind of all over the place, easy distractibility, short attention span. He says there's a tendency for kids in this stage to be kind of sloppy and kind of messy and kind of disorganized. There's usually toys all over the place. They'll be playing with something, drop it right where it is, and they'll move on to the next thing. And if you want to find a kid in the house, just follow the trail of toys. It'll lead you to them. As soon as something else catches their eye, they drop what they're doing and they move on to the next thing. Freud said some of those characteristics stick with us as we progress through these stages. A tendency to be very reactive, to be overly spontaneous, to be impulsive. A number of years ago, the noted American playwright Neil Simon wrote a comedy for Broadway. The play was called The Odd Couple. It was later made into a movie with Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon, later made into a television series that's still on cable on reruns, with Tony Randall and Jack Klugman. There were two participants in that play, or in that series. One of the characters was a guy by the name of Oscar Madison. Two guys who were exact opposites, trying to live together and share an apartment, both of whom were either separated or divorced from their spouse. Oscar Madison was an absolute slob. He'd get up in the morning and there would be the dishes that he used last night at supper left on the coffee table because he was sitting in front of the TV watching some kind of a sporting event and just left the dirty dishes there. He was a constant cigar smoker and he was always dropping cigar ashes all over the place. He'd look around and if he couldn't find an ashtray, he'd put his cigar out in his coffee cup with a little bit of coffee left in the bottom. I mean, the guy was just a pig. You walk into his room, Jesus, it looked like an explosion in a clothing factory. There was stuff on the dresser, on the floor, on the bed, piles of clothes all over the place. You couldn't tell which was the pile of clean clothes, which was the pile of dirty clothes. Stuff hanging out of dresser drawers, shirts hung over doorknobs. What a pig. I mean, the guy was just incorrigible. A real absolute slob. That is a representation of an expulsive personality. There are people in this world whose lives are commitments to chaos and disorganization. Sloppy, messy, disorganized, lacking in structure. Hell to live with. You gotta follow them around with a shovel. Clean up after. God! And the upside is that they are expressive and affectionate and demonstrative and caring, and you never have to wonder how they feel about you. They show it. And if they really like you or they're pleased with something you just said, they'll give you a hug. They are, in fact, some of the most generous people in the world. They are generous to a fault. They'd give you anything they have. Hell, they'd give you the shirt off their back. They wouldn't wash it first. But they'd give you the shirt off their back. Those are the expulsive people. As soon as a thought enters their head, they blurt it out their mouth. The other character in the play is a guy by the name of Felix Unger. Neat, clean, squeaky clean, tidy, well-organized, systematic, methodical. He represents the second stage, the retentive stage. If I had to come up with one word to describe this one, it would be compulsive, not impulsive. Compulsively neat and clean and tidy and structured. Pardon? Yep. Yes, Jack Nicholson is OCD. Yep. Obsessive compulsive disorder. Only this is within normal limits. And Felix Unger is an immaculate person. He's always incredibly well-groomed, neat and tidy. Their life is a commitment to structure, order, orderliness, neatness. They believe in such things as cleanliness is next to godliness, a place for everything and everything in its place. They're always impeccably well-groomed, never a hair out of place. Clothes are color-coordinated. There are people in this world that you walk into the place where they live and it looks like something out of Better Homes and Gardens. Dear God, you could eat off the floor. Nothing is ever out of place. You walk into their room, it's the exact opposite. There's nothing out of place. You open the closet door, and everything is hung up facing in the same direction, inch and three quarters apart. Everything is grouped according to color, different shades of the same color, different hues. Nothing hanging over doorknobs, hanging over the door, no piles of clothes on the floor or on the bed. You open the dresser drawers and things aren't stuffed in there. They're folded in these neat little piles. The socks are rolled together and folded just so. Neat, clean, tidy, well-organized, systematic, methodical people. They make wonderful librarians. You never have to wonder where the damn books are. They're right on the shelf where they belong according to the Dewey Decimal System. Unlike the expulsive person who's everything, you know, King Midas in reverse, everything they touch turns to horse manure. I mean, my God, if you look in the trunk of somebody who is an expulsive personality or look in the back seat of their car, you wonder why the hell the Board of Health didn't shut them down. They have all their worldly possessions in that damn car. And there's flies around it. I mean, it's just an absolute mess. These people, neat, polished, squeaky clean, everything just right. You look at their desk, all the papers are stacked in neat little piles, all the pens and pencils are lined up in a row, everything is polished just the way it ought to be. They not only make wonderful librarians, they are excellent candidates for careers in military service. Yes, sir, no, sir. Everything by the book. They don't send out invitations without consulting the etiquette book. If they write personal correspondence by hand instead of on a computer, they make sure before they put it in the envelope that all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted and everything's no misspellings, no smudges on that paper. Everything is just right. They're very concerned with what the neighbors will think. Very concerned about the opinion of others. These are people who are very scrupulous, people who are very moralistic. They are often people who are devoutly religious, very high moral standards. Rigidity and inflexibility in many spheres of their life. These are people who equate security, the retentive people, listen carefully, who equate security with collecting things. They like accumulating stuff. And although their house is immaculate, somewhere in that house or apartment, there's a closet. And if you open the damn door the wrong way, you are going to die in an avalanche of crap. And it's all in there. You go down in their basement and you could kill yourself. They have everything they ever acquired, broken or not. And you say, why don't you throw that piece of junk out? Oh, no, I'm not going to throw that out. The only thing that's wrong with that is this little thing here is broken, and someday I'm going to get around to fixing it. As little kids, they collect dolls, Hot Wheels cars, baseball cards, you name it. They collect stuff. including money. These people are so damn stingy that when they walk, they squeak. If they step on a dime, they can tell you whether it's heads or tails. They have the first buck they ever made. And when they get angry with you, they withhold themselves. Whereas the expulsive is very expressive and demonstrative and affectionate. This person, when they get pissed off at you, they cut you off, man. They don't talk to you. The cold shoulder treatment? You walk in and say, hi, how are you? And they say, fine. What's up? Is something wrong? Oh, nothing. And that's the end of the conversation. Whatever room in the house they're in, it's 10, 15 degrees colder than the rest of the house. Because you tick them off. And they give you the cold shoulder. That's it. They withhold themselves emotionally from you. They're not very forthcoming to begin with, and when they're angry. Let me tell you about these people. They carry a grudge to their grave. They never forgive you. Slight them, do something to offend them, they never, ever forget it. Forget, forgive. They never forget it, let alone forgive. Their birthday's coming up, and you say to them, hey, what do you want for your birthday? And they protest and say, God, please, I don't need a thing. Don't get me anything. Please, don't buy me a present. God forbid you don't buy them a present. They will never forgive you, and they will never forget the birthday when you didn't get them a present. They won't tell you what they want, because if you really loved them and cared about them, you should know what they want. You shouldn't have to ask. You wrap your damn brain, you go out and buy them a present, you wrap it up, put a bow on it, give it to them, along with a card, they smile, open the present, and you know as soon as they open the damn present, you're screwed up. It's the wrong thing, it's the wrong color, it's the wrong size, it's the wrong shape. They're not going to forgive you for that either. You should have gotten the right thing. Freud says these are the character traits and the personality characteristics that reflect those two extremes in terms of the anal stage. Holding on, letting go. Giving, receiving. Once again, extremes. If you've read the handout, you know what I'm talking about in terms of the opposites of polarity here. What accounts for the difference? Freud says there's several ways of toilet training too. And the crucial issue here is toilet training. The battleground is the family bathroom. The issue, who's going to be in control of that child's body? The parents or the kid? Now, do you win the kid over, and are they effectively toilet trained because they want to please you because of everything you do for them, and you use a very positive approach, and you reward and praise their successes, and you overlook their mistakes? Freud said, if you take that approach, that laid-back, easygoing approach, what you typically tend to do is to toilet train a kid leaning more toward the expulsive side. Parents say, I'm not going to get bent out of shape about this. When the kid's ready, they'll be toilet trained. When the muscles are developed, they'll be able to do this, and I really don't give a damn as long as they're toilet trained by the time they go to school. I mean, these are very laid-back, easygoing parents who don't worry about it. Expulsive personalities. There are parents who are the other extreme. Oh, okay, 30 minutes after supper, let's go. Got to go to the bathroom, take the kid in, denude the child from the waist down, sit him on the family john, and he doesn't budge until something happens. These are parents who are rigid and inflexible, and their rigidity and inflexibility translates to the way they deal with the child. These are parents who, for example, dress the kid to go outside and play, and just as the kid is going out the door, they say, don't get dirty. How the hell do you go outside and play on a day when it's drizzling and there are mud puddles in the yard without getting dirty? Don't get dirty. According to this approach, retentive personalities are more likely to be produced by parents who use punishment, scolding, ridicule, and embarrassment, etc., in toilet training the child. They don't overlook the mistakes, they focus on them. They may give minimal praise for successes, but more often than not, They take a look at the accidents, the mistakes, and the delays in acquiring appropriate attitudes and cleanliness behaviors on the part of the child. And since there's usually more than one parent or more than one person involved in toilet training a child, what you typically end up is with most people being a combination of these, a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Okay. Anybody got a question on stage two?
Can a child or somebody develop to be have a little bit of, you know, like be have the isolation, but, you know, be isolated, but also be maybe be like cleanly or like almost like a perfectionist, and then also be outgoing and show emotion?
Yes, and we call that person normal because they're a combination of the two. That's what I said.
Okay.
If you take characteristics from both and put them together as a result of multiple parenting, as a result of more than one person being involved in toilet training, and when you end up somewhere in the matrix, that's normal. Either this way or that way is not normal, said Freud. Okay? Maladaptive, maladjusted, abnormal, the closer you get to either extreme. So one would certainly hope that the vast majority of people would end up being that combination. How they combine which traits, that varies from person to person. But we're not there yet, and we're not ready to address that. Yes?
Is that built on prior learning?
What built on prior learning?
Let's say, in the second stage, you said it's, you know, it's too extreme, it's falsive and retentive. Would, let's say, the prior, what they learned in, let's say, in the oral stage.
Yes, absolutely. Folks, do not think of these stages as discrete and separate. What happens in phase one of stage one is mixed with what happens in phase two of stage one. After that is blended together and the child moves on to stage two, then we superimpose and mix with that what happens in phase one of stage two and what happens in phase two of stage two. And it becomes increasingly complex admixture of what is developing in each of the phases of the stages. Stage three, phallic stage. Freud considers this the most critical stage of the psychosexual stages. Most critical. What develops in this stage? Gender identity and the acquisition of sexuality. Kids who are between 18 months and 5 years old love motion. They run from place to place instead of walking. It might be laborious or an effort for us to get from one place to another. If we had to run, they love it. They run constantly. They love to be active. They love to be doing things. They love to be on the go. In going through the process of toilet training, so psychoanalytic theory, kids are immobilized. As I said a few moments ago, periodically or episodically during the day, kids are denuded from the waist down. Parents sit them on the john. They expect for something to happen. And kids sit there waiting for something to happen, suffering from what we might best describe as excruciating boredom. As a result of that, says Freud, kids make an interesting discovery. They came into this world with a certain amount of sexual equipment. Aha! They not only discover that it's there, but they discover that when it's manipulated, it produces distinctly pleasurable sensations. And there begins a process by which kids engage in increasing their awareness of themselves through self-stimulation, self-exploration. Freud had a term for this. He called it infantile masturbatory activity. I'm really hard-pressed to attribute sexual motivation to what's going on with the child. He's learning about that part of his body, or that part of her body, like any other part. Freud says this is a normal phase and aspect of development that all kids are going to go through. It's not worth getting bent out of shape about, but parents do get bent out of shape about. This is the stage of development where once kids kind of get into this as a pastime, parents are constantly saying things to kids like, cut that up, will you? Hey, leave yourself alone, pal. Don't do that. That's not nice. We're in public. Stop that, will you? Some parents get really creative, and they convince the child that it's not only bad and naughty, but it's sinful. Some people, like my grandmother, get really creative and instill in the child a fear of self-injury. Don't do that. You're going to hurt yourself. My grandmother taught me and my two brothers, don't touch it. It'll fall off. I swear to God. That may not be a big deal when you're that age, but boy, when you get to be 14, 15, and 16, and that's buried somewhere in your unconscious, it can be problematic from time to time. Freud says what's really important here is not what the kid is doing, but what's the reaction of the adults to that behavior on the part of the child, particularly when the child does it in public. Most parents feel the need to interrupt it as an ongoing behavior pattern, especially in public. So somehow the behavior is interpreted to the child as being unacceptable, inappropriate, not nice, naughty, sinful. Whatever the interpretation is, says Freudian psychoanalytic theory, all kids going through this end up with some feelings of shame, embarrassment, and or guilt associated with the genital region of the body as a result of how they are responded to by socializing adults. Feelings which, says Freud, each of us is going to have to overcome later on in the course of our development if we are to achieve a normal, healthy sexual adjustment later on. So in phase one, says Freud, we acquire an awareness of our gender identity, an awareness that we are either male or female. Kids aren't dumb. They put the pieces together and come up with the conclusion that there are two types, type A and type B. Girls and boys are boys and girls, and if they're type A, there's a type B, and they're different. Kids start to get curious about the psychology of sexual differences. So the period of time during this stage when kids are really into their own anatomy is called the autoerotic phase. That's phase one. Self-awareness, self-stimulation, self-manipulation, self-gratification, whatever. The second phase is called the heteroerotic phase. That's where kids really get into sexual differences. That's putting it mild. This is what many parents refer to as the playing doctor phase of development. I had four kids, one of whom didn't play doctor. He ran a free clinic for the whole damn neighborhood. It was absolutely amazing. I have an old farm that I live on. I bought many, many years ago. It was an old dilapidated barn on the back of the property. And Mrs. Tarney, bless her little heart, couldn't figure out what the hell the fascination was with that old barn. But there was always a bunch of bicycles outside. And one day she happened to wander back into that old barn and called me here in shock and horror. She said, "You will not believe what he was doing in that barn today." I said, "Oh, yes, I will. I know that kid. What was he doing?" She walks into the barn, and there's my son in the middle of an intricate surgical procedure on another child from the neighborhood, with a bevy of attending physicians standing around trying to look over his shoulder to get a better view, playing doctor. Freud says this process, his theory says that this process is a normal aspect of development. The heteroerotic phase, becoming aware of sexual differences. Kids of different gender are sometimes bathed together. Parents take the kids to the shore. They get their bathing suits on in the same room. They become aware of the fact that there are sexual differences, and their curiosity is awakened. Now stick with me. This is going to get more complicated. Once the kid figures out that there are boys and girls, they add two and two together and come up with four and discover that boys grow up to be men and girls grow up to be women, and they become curious about sexual differences between men and women. When kids get to this point in their development, you learn to lock the bathroom door when you take a shower. Because if you don't, suddenly there will be the patter of little feet, and somebody will pull back the shower curtain and say, "Hey, how come you have one of those and I don't?" The kids begin to ask all kinds of embarrassing questions like, "Where do babies come from?" They start verbalizing questions about matters related to sex and sexuality. Questions which sometimes parents have difficulty answering without some degree of discomfort, depending on the nature of the question. Okay, we might as well address this right here at this point in time. This is the stage, says Freud, that is the most important because it's associated with the development of our sexual identity. And it is also the stage when, for the first time, each and every individual encounters their first major complex in life. Complex! A cluster of related thoughts, feelings, perceptions, and memories which center around a particular topic that is one which is has strong emotional content. A complex, and the one complex, the first complex is Freud, that we experience in the second phase of this third stage, and it's called the Oedipus complex. To be technically correct, it's known as the Oedipus complex in the male child. It's known as the Electra complex, E-L-E-C-T-R-A, the Electra complex in the female child. Oedipus and Electra. Please note that although those names for these complexes are derived from Greek mythology, this idea in Freud's theory is not. It is borrowed from Charles Darwin. It is an evolutionary concept, Darwinian in origin. Says Freud, once the child, the male child, becomes, and we'll deal with these separate to give equal time to both, once the male child discovers that boys grow up to be men and girls grow up to be women, he begins to look at and observe the interaction between mother and father or father substitute, can be a surrogate parent, can be a stepfather, can be the mother's fiancé, can be whomever. The male child begins to perceive that there is a difference in the way the mother relates to him in terms of time, interest, attention, affection, closeness, care, and the way she responds to the father figure. And the father seems to get more time and interest and attention and respect and acceptance and approval and affection than the male child. Says Freud, the male child begins to want more of the time, interest, attention, and affection that the father gets versus what he gets. He resents being relegated to a second-class position. Now, here's one of the things that I think Freud is never given enough credit for. He said, kids this age, and the age that we're talking about here roughly, may not exactly be 3 to 6, it may be 4 to 7, somewhere in that age range. Kids this age have a significant inability, and their inability is their ability to assume someone else's point of view. Kids cannot assume the perceptual frame of reference of another person. They are locked into viewing the world through their own eyes, their own ears, their own sense of touch, taste, smell, etc. First-hand experience is absolutely necessary for kids to know and understand things. So this male child now begins to want more of the undivided attention and closeness with the mother. What Freud is saying here is that the first significant emotional relationship any male child has with a mature female is the relationship that male child has with its mother during the course of its early developmental years. That's what he's saying.
Can I repeat that?
Repeat what? Yeah. The first significant emotional relationship any male has is with the parent of the mother, parent of the opposite sex. Now, you have to understand that while this dynamic thing is going on within the family, society is exerting pressure on kids based on their gender to adopt sex-appropriate attitudes and characteristics and behaviors. And kids at this age are learning that there are differences in games and differences in toys and differences in clothing and differences in expectations of kids depending on whether they're male or female. I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm not passing a judgment on it. I'm saying it's a fact. Deal with it. A little girl comes home with a horrible black eye and we are appalled and we say, "My God, who did that to you?" She starts to tell us about it and she gets upset and she cries. We give her a hug and we try to comfort her and to calm her down. Little boy comes home with the same black eye. We are equally appalled and we say, "My God, who did that to you? And what did you do to him?" There are differences in what we expect in terms of the expression of aggression, interpersonal relationships, the expression of affection. Then that little boy tries to tell us what happened and he gets upset and starts to cry and we say, "Shh, big boys don't cry. Stop crying and tell me what happened so we can get to the bottom of this." We treat kids differently based on their gender. We buy them different toys, different games, different clothing. We have different expectations in terms of expressions of affection. We have differences in terms of which ones we expect to be more action-centered and activity-oriented and which ones we expect to be more verbal and interpersonal and communicative. It's a fact of life. So what we have developing within the family thus far is this. Mother, father, child. And what's happening here, says Freud, is the development of an emotional triangle within the family between mother, father, and child. If it's a female child, that same emotional triangle develops. If we're talking about the Elektra complex, the little girl begins to notice there is a difference in the way the father treats the mother versus the way he treats her. He's more attentive. He's more concerned. He's more affectionate. He's more caring. There's more closeness. There's more communication. She begins to want more and more of her father's time, interest, attention, and affection. She wants her father to read her the story before she goes to bed. She wants to hold daddy's hand while crossing the street. She wants to sit on the couch next to her father while watching the television program, not her mother. First significant emotional relationship with a person of the opposite sex is the male figure. In the case of the female, it's called the Elektra complex. She begins to want more of the father's time, interest, attention, and affection to the extent that she wishes to displace or replace the mother as the sole recipient. In the case of the boy, he wishes to replace and displace the father as the sole recipient of the mother's affection. So now we've got a conflict. A relationship conflict. These strange new feelings of attraction toward the opposite sex parent, feelings of competitiveness and rivalry with for the parent's attention and affection, with the same-sex parent. And Freud says these kinds of conflicting emotions build to the point where they demand some kind of resolution. Here it is. Through a series of accidental or trial and error learning experiences, sexual identification. This is where the term role model comes from. Through a series of trial and error learning experiences, that male child, who now has feelings of competition and rivalry with the father, and assumes, because he can't assume someone else's point of view, that because he has feelings of competitiveness and rivalry with his father, that the father feels the same way toward him, that it's a two-way street. So he feels conflict and guilt over the attraction toward his mother, and he now comes to be fearful of the father's aggressive potential. He's bigger, he's stronger, he's got a booming voice. The fear of physical harm from the father. In the case of the girl, she looks at that relationship, and she sees that the mother gets more of the time, interest, and attention. So what she tries to do is to displace or replace the mother. She wants to be the sole recipient of her father's affection. Conflict in those three relationships also builds, and it demands resolution. Sexual identification, original to Freud's theory, first introduced by Freud, is one of the most widely accepted concepts based on Freud's theory. In our culture, in our society today, we have a number of programs that are based on a belief in this concept. Programs like Big Brother and Big Sister. Kids who come from homes where the appropriate adult parent of the same sex is not there. There's an attempt to provide them with adequate role models to identify with. Sexual identification is a process by which a child switches back from the opposite sex parent to the same sex parent and gives emotional allegiance to the parent of the same sex, and then attempts to duplicate in himself or in herself the attitudes, the traits, the characteristics, the mannerisms, the gestures, and according to my wife, even some of the more colorful language of the same-sex parent. What's the process all about? The development and the acquisition of sexuality. The acquisition of the characteristics of either masculinity or femininity. In phase one, we learn about our gender, male and female. In phase two, through sexual identification, we acquire the characteristics that are sanctioned by our culture and our society for someone of that gender. The acquisition of sexuality, masculinity, and femininity. Two persons are participating in this process. The adult who's being identified with is called the role model. The child who's doing the identifying is called the identificand. C-A-N-D, identificand. That's the one who's doing the identifying. Now, what you need to put in your notes is that, according to Freud, this is an automatic, unconscious process. The child is not doing this by intent or consciously intending to do it. It's a process that happens. And according to Freud, since it's an automatic, unconscious process, if the appropriate model for the child to identify with is not there, the child will select a substitute. An older sibling in their teens, an uncle, a grandparent, father's fiance, the mother's boyfriend, stepfather. If the appropriate model is not there, the child will select a surrogate or substitute model to identify with. And rather than have it be somebody the child encounters in the street, there are many programs designed to try to provide kids with healthy adult role models to identify with. According to psychoanalytic theory, there are three necessary conditions that have to be met in order for normal, healthy sexual identification to take place. Number one, the child must perceive some initial similarities between themselves and the model. Being of the same sex, wearing similar clothing, occasionally being told by father, you're just like mommy. Or occasionally being told by the mother, you're just like your daddy. Number two, the model must be perceived as a source of power. Do not misunderstand what is meant by that. That means the child must see that adult model as a competent, strong, effective, adequate person, somebody who makes things happen in the world of the child, somebody you'd want to grow up and be like, someone that you would aspire to become like. Not somebody who's being constantly put down or criticized or ridiculed or demeaned by the other parent, but somebody who's held in high esteem. And so what happens is that the child expresses an interest in participating in a variety of activities with that parent. They are called role functions. If the father is going to Home Depot to pick up a new spark plug for the lawnmower, or he's putting on a new set of hinges, or he's doing something in the yard, if he's raking leaves, he has a little companion with him who wants to help him take the ride with him and go to the store. If the mother is doing something domestic around the house, now I'm not talking about what she does at work, but what she does at home, that this little child can see, the little girl expresses an interest in helping and in participating, running the vacuum, dusting, cooking, baking, doing a variety of activities that the girl can see the mother engaging in, that she wants to participate with the mother. And all the while this participation is going on, the child is soaking up her observations like a sponge, or the little boy is. Okay? So engaging in a variety of role activities that are typical for that person. Number three, third, last but not least, says Freud, the model must be perceived by the child as a source of emotional nurturance. If the child is going to take a chance and switch back from the opposite sex parent to the same sex parent or parent substitute and try to get close to that person and become like that person, it must be reasonable for the child to assume that they will be responded to with acceptance and affection and caring, not with anger or hostility or rejection. So something that would facilitate that closeness and becoming like that person. All three of those conditions have to be met, and met to the right extent, says Freud, if normal, healthy sexual identification is to occur. If that doesn't happen, Freud says, gender identity issues and problems will accrue as a result. Questions and concerns about one's attractiveness to people of the opposite sex, concerns about one's sexual orientation, concerns about one's gender identity. All of those kinds of issues and problems are the outgrowth of faulty or defective identification, says Freud. And meeting those three conditions within the right parameters, to the right extent, not too much and not too little, is what's necessary to facilitate this identification process. So what happens? Kid picks up a lot of stuff from the same-sex parent. And then before this whole process is over, because the critical age for this is from 3 to 7, and before the kid gets there, this whole process is interrupted, particularly in our culture and one that's similar to it, because the child enters the world of school. Separated from home for extended periods of time during the day, the child has entered into the society or subculture of childhood. Kids have to learn to deal with substitute adult authority figures called teachers. They are thrust into constant daily contact with their peers. Teachers don't have time to respond to kids' emotional and social needs in this regard the way parents do. Here's the important thing. Kids go to school. The relationship at home is de-intensified because kids are removed from that family environment, in most instances, for 6 or more hours a day. Going to school, entering into the subculture of childhood. The child takes what he or she learned from identifying with the parent to school with them. They try it out with their peers. What meets with success among their peers, they keep. What peers don't accept, kids get rid of, and they replace it with new things that they pick up from their peers. So now they have new identification models. Peers. So this little cherub that you raised with tender loving care for the first five and a half years of its life, you send the kid off to school and within 6 weeks they come home with some very interesting new vocabulary words that you didn't teach them. They've got some remarkable hand gestures that give you gray hair when they use them in front of their grandparents. They have a new walk. They've got new attitudes. What they are doing is identifying with their peers, and they exclusively identify, at least initially, with peers of the same gender, and they add to and enrich what they acquired from identifying with parents. Question. Folks, we are rounding the three-quarter pole here, heading into the home stretch. Next evaluation is just around the corner. If you don't have any questions, may you rest in peace.
For the role model, what child?
Identification. Significantly. And I'm not at all sure that when Freud was designing his theory, that was something that happened as a matter of course. I would say that probably the peers that would be the most influential would be siblings. And in most American households, 85 to 87% of all kids have at least one sibling or more. Next.
What if the child is brought up in, let's say, you already touched on this, but let's say rather than the parents be there, they have the grandparents there, but they know they have a mother and a father. How will that, you know, that affect?
Different ways in different stages. I can't give you a general answer to that. Depending on the model that the child selects to identify with and which one is facilitated. Yes?
In the anal stage,
yes.
The first phase, the corpus stage, can a child carry that into adolescence?
Carry
those behaviors.
Absolutely. Freud says to a greater or lesser degree, each of us carries characteristics of each phase of each stage all the way through adulthood.
Can a child carry those
older or younger?
Either or. Does it happen?
If they're extremely close in age, it might. But I would think not. It seems to me that the general rule of thumb, older siblings closest to us in age are more influential than any other sibling in the family, if that answers part of your question. And they influence patterns of loyalty and protection and cooperation and conflict resolution that we learn, but not necessarily gender identity. Although research tells us that boys who have older sisters closest to them in age are typically more verbal. They tend to do better in school. They are more relationship and interpersonally oriented. Okay. Girls who have older brothers are more activity-centered and action-oriented. They tend to participate more in sports and those kinds of recreational activities, and they may be less interpersonal and more object-oriented or more activity-oriented than interpersonally and verbally oriented. There may also be some changes in terms of emotionality.
Is there anything anybody, let's say it's like you have an Oscar Madsen or a, the other guy,
Felix,
that's not, like, is there anything later in their life that they can do to tone it down or kind of go back to a little bit of normalcy, or is that with them for life?
The answer is yes to both questions. To a greater or lesser degree, it's going to be there, but according to Freud, through therapy, particularly insight therapy, some of those reactions can be toned down. Very often they are reactions that are most pronounced in times of stress or when the person is experiencing anxiety. And if we learn other ways of adapting to those sources of psychological discomfort, yes, things can change. But ordinarily, it's through therapeutic intervention of some type. Other questions? I want you to remember I had announced last week this class will not meet on Thursday. I will see you then for 1 week from today. We will conclude Freud's theory, and we are going to move on to a discussion of the psychology of adjustment from Freud's point of view. That's it for today. We'll see you 1 week.